Good afternoon. Welcome once again to Line One, your health connection from Alaska Public Media in Anchorage, Alaska. I'm your host, Dr. Thad Woodard. Any quantity of alcohol during pregnancy has been associated with a host of potentially lifelong effects on the developing fetus. It's estimated that as many as maybe 1 in 100 children in the United States have a disorder called fetal alcohol spectrum disorder. This disorder includes problems with physical, mental, behavioral, and even learning disabilities. There is no treatment that reverses these effects. On this program, we're going to look at the evidence for fetal alcohol spectrum disorder, describe the effects more specifically, discuss how the diagnosis is made, and current efforts for treatment and prevention of this disorder, of these disorders. Our guests are Marilyn Pierce Bolger. She is a family nurse practitioner. She's been involved in the diagnosis and management of fetal alcohol spectrum disorder since about the year 2000 in Alaska, and she's currently the owner and manager of a agency that is the diagnostic state of Alaska, or Anchorage's diagnostic team coordinator, and heads that agency. And also with us is Betsy Cheevers. Betsy is the state of Alaska fetal alcohol spectrum disorder case manager in Anchorage, and also is a delightful woman, Eva Joe. Eva is with us today in the studio as well, and she has agreed to come on. She's diagnosed in year 2010 with fetal alcohol spectrum disorder, and she'll let us know a little bit about what that's like, and particularly what it may be like trying to find the diagnosis and how case managers, people helping individuals with certain chronic disorders, can manage to work through the system and improve their outcomes as a consequence. You can reach us with these questions that you may have or even comments. If you live in Anchorage, 550-8433 is our current number, 550-8433. We also have a toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752. And our email address is line1@alaskapublic.org. Eva, first, let me just say thanks to you for taking the time and having the courage to come in and talk with us. You're delightful to talk to.
You're very welcome.
It's a pleasure to have you take the time to come. Listening to you before the program, I'm amazed at how smart you are and how well-adjusted you are.
Yes.
Betsy, thanks for coming.
It's great to be here,
and especially with Eva.
Okay, thanks. And Marilyn, it's your return, I guess.
Thank you. You reminded me
several years ago we did a fetal alcohol program before.
Yeah.
So let's start by asking the question is, what do we know about alcohol and its effects on the developing fetus, and why might fetuses be so susceptible?
Alcohol is worse. Unfortunately, the legal drug is worse than anything else in terms of its impact on fetal development. So alcohol is what we call a teratogen, which means that it can actually kill and alter cells. It can influence the nerve development in addition to structural and other anomalies in the fetus, depending on the timing in the pregnancy of when the alcohol exposure happened and the dose of the alcohol, the mother's genetics, the baby's genetics. There's a lot of variables that look at that. It has many ways in which it may cause that injury, and there's tons of research going on actually internationally right now looking at this and trying to figure out what could we do to mediate this, the impact of alcohol prenatally.
Perhaps the public doesn't think the way that medical people do, but right after pregnancy, there's a single cell that begins to divide, and very quickly neural components of the nervous system are beginning to form within weeks, days. And now we know our nervous systems continue to develop dramatically, particularly the frontal lobes, where a lot of decision-making and risk-taking behaviors are through adolescence. So it helps us understand some behaviors of all of us at different times of our lives. So it makes sense that something that can affect that developing nervous system very early may have a lot of downstream kinds of effects.
Absolutely.
But we also know this could happen, it seems like, with alcohol at any time during the pregnancy.
The unfortunate thing is that because the central nervous system in the baby is developing throughout the pregnancy, there's really no time when you can use alcohol and not have some impact on that aspect of the fetus. We know that the most challenging or the most worrisome use is if you have a high dose of alcohol over a short period of time. What I see happening with women today, and I've been a nurse midwife since 1982, so I've looked at, you know, reproductive age women over many years' time, women are doing more binge-level drinking. We've kind of caught up with men in terms of how we drink. And so I see women who don't drink every day, but they may have a couple shots and a couple of beers on a Friday night or a Saturday night. And unfortunately for us, for women, more than three drinks in a two-hour period of time over the course of an evening is the definition of a binge, and women don't realize that. So that short burst of alcohol can influence a fetus from the very initial stages. You mentioned the early, you know, sperm and egg getting together, and it takes about, from the time of fertilization, there's another week or so when that fertilized egg takes the route to get down the fallopian tube and land into the uterus. After that time, any of the alcohol use the mother may be using can directly impact the fetus. The things that we, or the embryo in that case, one of the things that's very striking, and I think a lot of people don't understand, is that to have a full FA, fetal alcohol syndrome diagnosis, the individual has to meet very certain medical criteria for that. One of the things is the facial features, the small eye opening, the very thin upper lip, and the very flat vertical groove under the nose and the lip, between the nose and lip. Those facial features are forming in the third week of gestation, which is right as this woman might be missing her period. Mm-hmm. So if we women aren't paying attention to our alcohol use in the context of where we are in our menstrual cycle or whether or not we may be doing anything to prevent an unintended pregnancy, we could be causing a problem and not realize it.
Another problem, it seems to me, looking at three women across the table from me, is that you may not know you're pregnant.
Absolutely.
And it may take several weeks to know you're pregnant. And so that is really a difficult problem that raises its head.
The other thing that's so striking for me, again, I have this long-term perspective of looking at women's reproductive lives for a lot of years. 50% of us were having unintended pregnancies in 1982. That number hasn't budged. We still, about half of us are getting pregnant when we don't plan to. So we have unintentional exposures. Women are out there living their lives and maybe not paying attention. And just because you didn't know you were pregnant and then you stop drinking after you realize it, your early alcohol use could have caused a problem. So that's a hard thing to tell somebody at a new prenatal appointment.
Eva, is that something that you knew a couple of years ago, or is it something that's begun to sink in because of your exposure with the medical community?
Sink in. I guess I really didn't know about that and thought about it until...
Yeah, I would think the minority of girls in their 20s and certainly younger are not aware of this problem. How about your friends?
I barely even have any friends.
Okay.
And the friends that I know, that I knew, I don't think they are aware of it also.
Uh-huh. One, you know, speaking about unintended pregnancies, one of the good news I've seen recently, there is a decrease in teen pregnancies that is occurring.
Yes.
And so there's some reason for that. And we are seeing a little bit better understanding of alcohol as a problem. And I was coming back from the East Coast last night and flying and read some stuff. And this is a little bit off the subject, but again, it stresses the importance of legal drugs. The major drug cause of deaths in the United States is illegal drug, alcohol.
Yes.
It is related to 33,000 traffic fatalities a year. And this is what blew me away, is if you figure that out, that's like having one 737 crash every day for a year.
Oh.
And we don't think of it like that.
No.
And the most undependable part of an automobile is the driver.
Yes.
Another thing that came out of this. So I wanted to share that. And so in the whole scheme of things, we have to be much more careful about these legal drugs and how we're using them. and there are consequences, and this is one that we're talking about today.
The other thing that I think is striking about our larger culture is we use alcohol to sell so many things, right? So we use alcohol marketing and other things, and so we give particularly adolescents a really mixed message about alcohol. You shouldn't use it till you're 21, but then we've got all these surrounding, you know, marketing messages that are out there in kids. It's sort of the forbidden fruit thing, and that's tough.
Let me remind listeners again, you're listening to Line 1, your health connection. Our local number today is 550-8433, 550-8433. Our toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752, and our email address, line1@alaskapublic.org. Betsy, you are a case manager. What does a discussion like this mean to you as a case manager? And I'm thinking about your whole experiences in healthcare and what you're doing day to day right now. How does it tie together?
Well, I have to admit, it's really quite frustrating because funding is, of course, one thing that we hear continually,
sure.
Nonstop, especially mm-hmm. with declining oil revenue. And case management is the number one thing individuals who have this diagnosis need desperately. 40%, it's estimated, 40% of incarcerated inmates have FASD. And if you think of that dollar sign to keep people incarcerated because they have an organic brain disorder, your blood should boil. Eva had said that she doesn't have many friends, and she is one of the most delightful, pleasant, humorous persons I have the pleasure to work with on almost a daily basis. And yet, individuals, again, with this diagnosis, find it very difficult to have long-term friends because people don't understand how their brain works. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the level of that we kind of set for people to meet our expectations assumes that everybody is functioning on the same level, and it simply isn't so.
Well, let's try to put some more face or understanding about the breadth of the spectrum of fetal alcohol. Marilyn, you've already alluded to the fact that any time you might have some exposure, it could have some consequences. But before we go to the consequences, I also want to ask again, you also mentioned that it's the quantity and maybe timing is important. Mm-hmm. The message I keep hearing in the media is any amount of alcohol can be a problem. But it's a little bit more detailed than that. We know mm-hmm. that, as you've implied, I think, or said already, is that binge drinking, the quantity amount, and even the spouses or boyfriends of women who go ahead and have children that are affected, that there's already this culture around too much alcohol use. So there's clearly seems to be quantity is a factor in this.
It's definitely a factor. The difficulty in we can't study it as well in humans as we can in animals. So a lot of our references are in the animal studies. But even with animal models, we're finding that small amounts of alcohol can alter, particularly brain function in these animals and how they can accomplish tasks that they're given in terms of their environment in which they live. The moderate amount of alcohol. So let's say you're somebody who doesn't drink every day, but you maybe drink a couple glasses of wine every night on the weekend, for example. If it happens to be at the exact wrong time when that embryo was very, very, very small, when you maybe didn't realize you're pregnant, the dose of the alcohol in a woman's body is dependent on her body weight, her fat and body water content, and whether she was eating. There's several factors that influence that, But the fetal impact of the ethanol, the ingested ethanol, happens virtually right away. And then the baby, the fetus, is getting some of this recirculated in the amniotic fluid. So not only are they getting it directly through the umbilical, you know, vascular system, but then they're getting that recirculated. And we know from research that the most harmful levels of alcohol are those where they may not have been able to, where the alcohol isn't cleared entirely out of the system. So multiple days in a row where a woman may have alcohol use. And we see that pattern here in Alaska where, let's say we have women that live in a more remote location where alcohol is not readily available, and then alcohol comes in on the jet or the plane or whatever, and there may be heavy use for a period of time until the alcohol is not there. But this woman may not be classified as an alcoholic or a really right. heavy alcohol user. One of the things we're finding in screening sorts of processes, which is, we'll talk more about prevention in a little bit, I think, but we are assuming, I think, that alcohol and fetal alcohol-related problems are more inherent with women who are chronic alcoholics, and that's really not the case. We have other women who are drinking simply episodically in larger amounts that mm-hmm. are causing problems. Mm-hmm. And the disability may be this hidden disability. It may not be the overt disability that we call fetal alcohol syndrome.
Yeah, well, that's a good way to segue into the idea. When I was in training, of fetal alcohol syndrome was what was everything was called. And now we've gotten much more sophisticated in understanding the consequences. Right. And there are, it's now called a spectrum disorder. So would you mind defining or at least trying to paint a picture for listeners of what we mean by these different different disorders?
Sure. FASD, first of all, that term is not a diagnosis. As you said, that's a spectrum of diagnoses. And they reflect varying impacts. And the impacts, again, are going to depend on the dose of the alcohol and the timing and maternal, fetal, and father's genetics, basically. So full fetal alcohol syndrome only is about 9% of the individuals that we see through the diagnostic team have that diagnosis. They have to have full facial features. They have to have small growth stature, which is usually below third percentile. Depending on the diagnostic criteria, might be 10th percentile, and evidence of underlying brain injury. We see 90% of the individuals who come through the diagnostic team who have what we call either static encephalopathy, which is a term that refers to evidence of underlying organic brain injury that's not progressive, like an Alzheimer's, for example. This is a brain that was built differently because these neural pathways and connections got wired differently. They were put together at the beginning, not in the order in which they should have been. And so you see behavioral and learning disabilities as a result of that.
And it's a consequence of alcohol exposure of some amount.
Yes. So mm-hmm. that's static encephalopathy. Neurobehavioral disorder, I'm using terms that the University of Washington criteria categories outlined there. I'll give you a couple others in a minute that are used by Institute of Medicine National criteria. So the neurobehavioral disorder is another kind of lesser evidence of underlying organic injury, but there's still evidence of that. You'll also see terms in the literature for alcohol-related birth defects, which are the physical manifestations of alcohol exposure, and these can actually vary. We can see lots, depending on the alcohol exposure. If you have a child who has facial features, for example, they may have significant other midline birth defect evidence, such as very significantly differently shaped palates. We see cleft palate injury associated with alcohol exposure. We see ear malformations and joint laxity, GI, cardiac abnormalities, orthopedic things. There's a variety of structural things that you see sometimes if it's very early during the pregnancy. Alcohol-related neurodevelopmental disorder, or ARND, is, again, this hidden disability that's brain function is different, and they don't have the physical features, but they have this underlying, these disconnects, if you want to call them that.
So I'm a little bit confused by the term static encephalopathy and how you're using it here. I understand what a static encephalopathy is. That's the old cerebral palsy. Something happened. It's not progressive. Injuries happen. We don't know what it is. Mm-hmm. So is when you say static encephalopathy, are you talking about this alcohol-related neurodevelopmental disorder specifically? So
it's
an alcohol-induced static encephalopathy. There's something has happened during the development of this baby. It's affected their nervous system and left them with what kind of neurodevelopmental disorders?
There are a variety of things. So we can see individuals that have visual spatial processing issues. They might have executive function deficits. You were talking about frontal lobe function
right.
a while
Decision
ago.
Making.
So yes, exactly. Yep. So planning, organizing, attention problems. Mm-hmm. About 80% of the kids that come through the diagnostic team have had an attention deficit diagnosis first, because that may be how they're manifesting. Mm-hmm. But it's not your classic ADHD, and they may not respond the same way to stimulant medications, for example. Mm-hmm. We see a lot of language processing problems. Now, Eva was talking about having difficulty with friendships. So there's three aspects of language that we're looking at very in a detailed manner with a speech-language pathologist. So expressive language, which is how do you sound, and are you making sense in terms of your communication? Are you then receiving messages correctly? And social language, which is a huge piece, and one of the ones that we see a lot of these kids struggle with, is it's more subtle. It begins at a fairly young age, elementary age, and there are just these, they're having difficulty reading facial expressions, body language, scenes. You know, there might be a playground scene where the kids are fighting, and this kid who has an organic FASD disability may walk up and completely be clueless about what's going on in the context of that. Mm-hmm. And it makes them very vulnerable, because other individuals identify that they may have a little bit of a problem in that area and take advantage of them.
So as a physician, we're faced with kids that are having often developmental behavioral problems, sometimes before school, certainly once into school,
right.
Which can all of these things you've talked about can affect their ability to compete at the highest at the level mm-hmm. that their intelligence is. Mm-hmm. Intelligence is a different issue.
Right.
So it can get very, and then you have to throw on genetics and mm-hmm. environmental influences other than alcohol, and so it could get very difficult. And in fact, it seems that there's a lot of misdiagnosis
yes.
Because of this. When the characteristic facial findings are there, it makes it easier, obviously.
Right.
Tell us again those characteristics. How wide your eyelids are
the eye opening.
Left to right.
Yep.
So a narrow one is a suggestion.
And then you have the wide mid face. So
okay.
So the appearance is smaller eye opening, wide space
right.
between the eyes.
All right.
Very flat vertical groove under the nose.
It's called the philtrum.
Philtrum. Yep.
Uh-huh.
And a very thin upper lip. And there's some variations with ethnicity. The University mm-hmm. of Washington created these lip philtrum guides
right.
a number of years ago that are visual cues of what individuals with full FAS might look like. We now actually use facial photoanalysis. So,
that's
so our practitioners,
now
our
much
practitioners
more sophisticated.
Take a digital photo mm-hmm. with a specific size marker that we put on the forehead of the individual. Mm-hmm. Then mm-hmm. we can tell the computer program what the pixels are for this photo, and then we can analyze it using the cursor on the computer.
So what I worry about so often is that people who are listening will automatically look at themselves in the mirror and say that. And what we don't know is what I want to know. I want to ask this: what is the specific? What's the predictive value of small palpebral openings? What's the of not having a philtrum, of a very narrow, thin upper lip, and then all of them together? So are any of them what we would call, absolutely diagnostic by themselves or together?
Together.
Yeah.
So what I always say to families when I'm talking to them after the fact, when we're done with the diagnosis and I'm discussing, facial features and other things, we're all looking at each other, looking
sure.
to see who's got thin
Absolutely.
Lips.
Yep, yep, yep.
There's lots of genetic variation. Mm-hmm. However, if you have the very small eye opening, no philtrum, and a very absent lip, there's nothing but alcohol that will cause those three facial features to be together.
Okay.
So I can actually make a diagnosis of fetal alcohol syndrome even if I don't have maternal alcohol history because
right.
of that.
All right.
So if you have full facial features, because of the timing of when those facial features were forming through the midline in about the third week of gestation, right, all of the down path or up path connections that had to happen after that were impacted by that alcohol exposure. So if the face is the mirror of the brain, and they've done MRI and functional MRI studies looking at individuals who have full FAS and how impacted they are, and they do tend to have much more significant impact in terms of their outcomes.
All right, I'm going to take a break now, and then when we come back, one of the first questions I'm going to ask, I was just writing down, is if you have the facial characteristic, does that predict neurodevelopmental? And then the converse, if you don't, if you have neurodevelopmental, does well, how do we put the draw it back to that particular cause? And then I got another question, and that is, you know, what about people who have plenty of exposure but don't seem to have any problems? Is that? And these are kind of epidemiologic or scientific questions that need to be answered as we try to make sure we've got the right associations going on. So let me remind everybody, you're listening to Line 1, your health connection. Our local number again is 550-8433, our toll-free number 1-888-353-5752, and our email address, line1@alaskapublic.org. We're going to take a very short break, and then we'll continue our conversation on fetal alcohol spectrum disorder with Marilyn Pierce Bolger, Betsy Chivers. Betsy Chivers. I had it wrong from the get-go. And Eva Joe. I'm Dr. Thad Woodard.
You're listening to Line 1, your health connection from Alaska Public Media. The program repeats tonight at 8 on KSKA Anchorage and will not be taking phone calls. You can find Line 1, your health connection on iTunes or listen at alaskapublic.org.
Welcome back. This is Line 1, your health connection from Alaska Public Media in Anchorage, Alaska. Again, I'm your host, Dr. Thad Woodard. We're discussing fetal alcohol spectrum disorder, and up to this point, we've tried to really ferret out all the different effects that have been associated with alcohol. And we're going to talk about that a little bit more, and then we're going to try to get into management and prevention. My guests are Marilyn Pierce Bolger. She's a family nurse practitioner. She's been involved since the year about 2000 with the state of Alaska's efforts to identify and treat fetal alcohol spectrum disorders. Betsy Chivers, who is a case manager for the state of Alaska on these disorders. And Eva Joe, who's graciously agreed to come on and talk about her experience in getting diagnosed with fetal alcohol spectrum disorder about 5 years ago. If you've got questions or comments, you can email us during the next 30 minutes or so at line1@alaskapublic.org. You can call us locally at 550-8433. Again, our toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752. And please remember, if you're listening on a Monday night between 8 and 9, that's a taped rebroadcast. We cannot or will not be able to answer your questions or comments at that time. So, Marilyn, we were kind of getting deeper into this association between alcohol and different effects, and it becomes clear that actually the fetal alcohol syndrome that I grew up in medicine knowing is a small percentage of what is really being diagnosed now, and those are individuals who have facial characteristics and maybe some other physical characteristics that clearly are, if put together, can only be explained by alcohol exposure.
That's
individually,
right.
Each of those may not mean anything because there's other genetic factors, and I think it's very important that the listening audience recognize that.
Yes.
However, we now also are very keenly aware that there's a spectrum of neurodevelopmental issues, processing, memory, attention, distractibility, ability to process information that seems to track very well with these with alcohol-related issues as well in children. So where we left things, I was going to ask you, if an individual has the facial characteristics, is it pretty likely that the neurodevelopmental findings are going to be present?
I would say usually,
okay.
But we've had some individuals recently who had full facial features,
mm-hmm.
didn't have growth features, and actually were functioning reasonably well. Now, part of that depends on the timing of when you might be evaluating a child. So you have limited tools, if you want to think of them this way, with regard to when you what you can use on a child under the age of 6, for example. You can't do a lot of executive function assessment and some of the other things, attention, objective attention processing sorts of things are better done at a little bit older age. So we'll see individuals sometimes whose diagnosis may have actually shifted slightly. We might have seen them at a younger age. They had a diagnosis of neurobehavioral disorder when they were under age 5, perhaps. And then when we see them later, they have further evidence of impact. So generally, the face is the window to the brain, but because there are so many variables and factors that influence how alcohol does what it does, that we don't even know what they all are yet. The researchers are looking at that. We do have some folks who function. I had a reporter who sat in with a diagnostic meeting about a year ago, and he listened to us do a diagnosis for 3 individuals. That day, it happened to be that all 3 of those individuals turned out to have full FAS. One was in the gifted program in the Anchorage School District. One had an IQ in the mid-50s, and another mm-hmm. child had their IQ in the mid-80s. So it can be quite variable.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things you said earlier about intellectual ability that I just wanted to point out, because folks aren't aware of this, is alcohol is fairly unique in that it does impact IQ. It is the number one cause of preventable intellectual disability in the U.S.
Mm-hmm.
So if you have a child that's got an IQ on the lower end of things, and mm-hmm. alcohol was part of the story, it's mm-hmm. often mm-hmm. that is the etiology for the problem.
All right. So let's, if you don't mind, focusing on this neurodevelopmental disorder component without the physical components, and how do we make that, what are the diagnostic criteria that help us hone in with some certainty that alcohol is the contributing factor, given that environment, given that other genetic impact can lead to these same issues?
There are some things that are more closely associated with alcohol. Sensory processing can be one of them. You alluded to that a few minutes ago. If your neural pathways were built differently, you may be very overly sensitive or undersensitive to visual, auditory, sensory, oral sensory, a lot of different things like that. We see individuals with this pragmatic or social language issue pretty frequently, and that's not necessarily specific to alcohol, but very commonly associated with alcohol exposure. The visual spatial processing problems and visual motor integration things are very common. You might have an individual whose eyesight is fine, but when they go to put their visual perceptual with motor components together, like to reproduce a geographic form on a piece of paper for an occupational therapist, they really their brain is not taking that message in or getting it out again correctly. The executive function issues, and then adaptive living is the biggie. And Eva's probably a good example and can talk a little bit about some of the things she struggled with, because your adaptive living deficits are really the things that we all need to be able to do to succeed in the world. And so if we're not doing what our peers, our same age, are able to do, so in school, we'll see kids in third grade who are really starting to have difficulty with math and reading and writing. Handwriting might be a problem. They may be starting to have more difficulty with figuring out the friendship connections. In high school, you may see kids that are starting to have more oppositional behaviors because they know they're different and they're not fitting in and they don't know why. You know, they're really struggling. Mm-hmm. As a young adult, these individuals may really struggle with maintaining a job, maintaining a household, managing money, those kinds of things. So the adaptive living piece is huge.
My understanding also is there's an overall effect on growth that is another important hint, that small head circumference, small growth, relative to what the genetics should be for this family.
Yes.
So some of us are small.
Right.
And again, you have to take all that into consideration. But a person who is unusually small head circumference and this conglomeration of symptoms is a lot more apt to
have more difficulties.
And it's possible that that's related. And again, the problem is getting a reliable history from mom sometimes 10 years later, which is understandable, or even at the very early because of concerns about talking about that.
You know. One of my thoughts about that whole alcohol information transmission is a lot of us, the obstetrical providers are often getting that information. We're just not providing that to the pediatric folks, mm-hmm. so you don't have mm-hmm. that as part of your mm-hmm. differential. Mm-hmm. If we were to look at how could we make that, conveying that information as part of that child's story from the beginning and making sure that information got transferred to pediatric records, that would make our life a lot easier.
All right, I want to bring our other two guests in. We've not done that, but before I do it, we got one email. Can you address any research on whether or not fathers who are alcoholic, drinking a lot, and the effects on their sperm, can that lead to any of the problems we've discussed, or is this solely an issue that seems to be a maternal effect?
The father's drinking does influence, can influence the pregnancy. There's some research looking at sperm development, and there are heightened numbers of abnormal sperm, which often cannot then fertilize an egg, but if they did, they may carry abnormal genetic material or chromosomes that are then getting passed on into the fetus. You can only have fetal alcohol syndrome if you've been basically in a woman who was pregnant and drinking, but the father's sperm does matter in terms of the quality of the sperm that was part of that fertilized egg. The other thing that is a rule that a lot of men forget about is their drinking influences their partner's drinking. So if you want her to stop, you need to stop too.
Mm-hmm. All right. So, Betsy, you're a case manager. What does that mean? What do you do day to day? How do you get involved with Eva and how? I'll ask Eva how she's benefited from having a case manager.
Well, I have the best job in the world. I get to help people every single day doing all kinds of different things that they have difficulty with. The state of Alaska has set aside money for case management, particularly looking at the social work arena, because we as social workers are specifically trained to provide kind of a broad range, a spectrum of help to all of our individuals. My caseload, my youngest individual is 6. I have 2 6-year-olds, and my oldest is 35. So the range is pretty incredible. Kids nowadays, especially in the Anchorage School District, have a vast array of supported services, and teachers, educators are kind of on the lookout for kids that are having problems. So kids get a lot of supportive services. There's lots of funding through Medicaid for those services. Most of the kids have additional occupational therapy, speech therapy, and then mental health therapy on top of that many, many times. That's all covered by Medicaid. Adults, though, many, like Eva, do not have Medicaid. So hopefully in September, when the governor gets his Medicaid bill through, some of my adults will have additional therapeutic opportunities. However, for speech therapists and occupational therapists here in Anchorage, they focus on the kids. So even if those therapies were available to the adults, they're very difficult to get.
So I want to make it clear, we can't reverse the effects. However, we can maximize the potentials and help people learn to work around some of their difficulties.
Absolutely.
You know, my mind works pretty good. I think I'm pretty good at communicating with people. I'm not very good at remembering people's names, for example, all right? So none of us have the full deck, so to speak. But individuals with these effects from alcohol may have a whole host of other things which can be remediated to some way, and you're helping them learn how to use the system to maximize those options.
Well, for instance, after the diagnosis, you get this pages of recommendations of how to improve your life, so to speak. Implementing them, like dealing with Social Security, is difficult for most normal people. Add a disability onto it, it's horrible.
And especially if you're planning your executive function and your ability to plan.
Absolutely. And the appeal process, Eva can attest to, is it's horrendous. Mm-hmm. It's horrendous. And again, you're focusing on someone with a disability. You look at even the state of Alaska, and again, I understand dwindling revenues, but the whole process for the developmental disability waiver that is critical for many individuals, disabled individuals. Individuals with FASD get lumped into the developmental disability situation, which disqualifies them, and they equally have a need. And again, you know, when you look at the number of adults incarcerated who has this potential diagnosis, I mean, there's huge funds being misdirected.
And what I'm hearing, and it reminds me, is, you know, we all think our healthcare system is great, and yet we've noticed on this program that compared to the rest of the world, we may be great at cancer diagnosis. We may be great at some of the most sophisticated surgery. When it comes to managing chronic diseases, we stink, and we have not been good at it. And this is kind of like a poster child. Yes. For the whole issue is the complexity of our system is keeping people who can and should be getting some care from getting it.
And these individuals who have this diagnosis are very capable. Mm-hmm. They are very talented. Mm-hmm. However, you put them in a regular job, they cannot function. Mm-hmm. I mean, individuals who can understand two-step processes cannot work at a multifunctional, you know, position and be successful, but they can do lots of other things. And the whole diagnosis is affected because it takes many Social Security, I'll pick on, wants to know when this disability occurs.
Right.
Well, it occurs at birth, and then the question is, why isn't it in their medical records? Mm-hmm. Assuming that at birth you can test individuals and say, oh, this person has FASD. So, you know, and many individuals do not have medical conditions that make them go to the doctor regularly. Mm-hmm. It is more behavioral or functional. Where do you go when you can't understand someone? You typically act out. And so, you know, again, very easy at school for teachers to have kids act out. But if you're already an adult you know, and you are not aware of this. You just get classified as someone who you know, is dysfunctional or criminal or behavioral, crazy, you know, all of those things. So, you know, it's very difficult.
Eva, tell us your story.
Well, it's really wonderful to have Betsy in my life. If it wasn't for her, then, you know, I wouldn't be here. And if it wasn't for Marilyn, too. I first met Marilyn when I was pregnant with my first daughter. And along with my other kids, except for my last one. And Betsy came along last year when I was pregnant with my last child. And ever since then, she's been there for me.
What have you gained the most? I mean, it sounds like you've got a diagnosis, and prior to the year 2010, you didn't have a diagnosis?
No.
But you thought something was different about you?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. It first started out at Covenant House, mm-hmm. and then they referred me over to Assets, and then that's when the whole process started. Getting the whole assessment and...
You're intelligent, obviously. Mm-hmm. What is it that you feel like you struggle with? What kinds of things?
Calendaring the stuff that I need to do throughout the week.
So planning on and prioritizing what you need to get done.
Yes.
That just doesn't happen.
No.
Without somebody's help, right?
Yes.
Okay.
And then time. So either I'll get there early on time or I'll get there late and then forgetting stuff.
But it's not them necessarily doing the work for you. It's just helping you be sure you are on task to get it done. You can do it.
Help me remember and stuff. Yeah, but right. I can do it myself, but sometimes, you know, I forget about it. And,
And is it your understanding that the reasons for this is probably related to a fetal alcohol spectrum disorder?
Yes. Yes.
can you say static encephalopathy?
Static encephalopathy. quite a little bit, yeah.
FASD is easier, isn't it?
Yes, FASD is easier.
Is it also fair to say that you understand a lot more of what how alcohol may have affected your life or has affected your life now? And is that helpful for you and how you raise your own kids and how you approach, you know, your day-to-day life?
It takes a really great toll on my life. I have trouble remembering to do stuff. Like get into appointments on time or forgetting about my appointments and brushing my teeth, I guess.
Right. Are you taking any medications of any sort?
I was on antidepressants. It was called sertraline, but I kind of stopped taking them. And no, I'm not.
Yeah, I would. Anybody with any chronic disease, doesn't matter what it is at high risk of depression.
Sure.
Nobody wants to feel different or abnormal. And obviously, and as we've talked about on the program, I think many people understand the medications are not the long-term answer. It's coming to grips with understanding the process, coping with the process in a much more educated way. And I would think, you haven't said this specifically, tell me if I'm wrong, that Marilyn and Betsy have been helpful in helping you get away from the need for the medications.
They've been a really great life.
One of the things I'll say about the diagnosis itself is we're looking for where their strengths in addition to where the challenges. So a lot of times individuals, it just helps them know who they are better because here's the things that we know you do really well, and here are the things that you already know you may have trouble with, and suggestions for things to help that. And I think that just under any, we all want to understand ourselves, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah. I failed to remind listeners that there's going to be another and more extensive educational session on fetal alcohol spectrum disorder called FASD Awareness Day, September 9th. That's just about a month from now, from 4:30 to 7:30 in the School District Educational Center atrium, which is on 5530 East Northern Lights. Let me give you a phone number to call if you want more information about this. 269-8926. That's September 9th, 4:30 to 7:30. A number of individual speakers knowledgeable on the issue of diagnosis, treatment, management of FASD. September 9th, 4:30 to 7:30. 269-8926. Again, if you want more information. While we were off the air, Marilyn, you mentioned that another misconception might be who's doing the drinking in the female age group. I would have guessed 18 to 22.
The new date is fairly alarming, actually. CDC's got some recent information, and the women who are acknowledging that they are continuing to drink in pregnancy are between the ages of 35 and 44. They're white. They're college educated. They are working. They want to continue to have their wine. Right. Is basically what right. we're seeing, right. and unfortunately, this is also the population that may be interested in, you know, baby Einstein after the baby's right. out. We want the perfect child and the baby that doesn't have a problem. I think they just haven't gotten the word about the yeah. fact that we don't know a safe amount of alcohol in pregnancy. And, right. and really the only way you can assure that you're not causing a problem is not drinking at all.
Yeah. And then if you are drinking, unintended pregnancy is another sub issue here. And I don't know the statistic on that. I mean, one of the reasons for decreasing teenage pregnancies is more awareness of options to yes. Prevent and protect against getting pregnant, and then doing things that they can do with, like, the morning after pill.
There's actually really interesting prevention work being done, both in Alaska and nationally. So more screening universally across the board with not just men, but women as well, or women, but men as well, around how do you use alcohol? You know, are you using it at a level that's a more at-risk level, which is what I was talking about earlier, the, you know, more than three drinks in 2 hours is, for a woman, a binge. And so if you as a health provider are screening, you know, on a regular basis, the patient population you work with, and they give you some information about how they're using alcohol that might be of concern, we providers have a really unique opportunity to have a brief conversation with somebody and do brief intervention around, you know, I'm a little concerned about how you're using the alcohol, and maybe you might think about doing that differently. For a woman, if she's not using effective contraception, suggesting that she do so if she wants to continue to drink in that way can also decrease risk. And there's a national Project Choices was a CDC-funded project done at a number of locations around the country, and they found very nice responses on the part of the women who were changing alcohol use and using more effective contraception. There's a misconception that the birth control pill is the most effective method that's actually out there. It's also the oldest. I mean, we've certainly had birth control pills since the 60s. But long-acting reversible contraception is really the way to go. And there's now an IUD for adolescents and for women who've never had had a pregnancy. Skyla's available. The Marina, you've got the Paragard, which has no hormone effect in it. Nexplanon is another user-independent product that we recommend for individuals who may have difficulty remembering, like Eva was talking about earlier. Sometimes we need our little external brain things to help us remember to use things.
I'd like to insert here, too. I work with not just the individuals, but the families, too. And I do not believe that any mother drinks to create a child with a disability. Right. you know, the mother is traumatized by the fact that she has a disabled child. And I think the bigger picture and the overall true way to get mothers not to drink is to provide support to them, because I think many mothers have their own traumas, they have their own experiences and lack of support that creates the need to self-medicate,
right.
Which
Thanks,
goes
Betsy.
To the drug that's legal and unfortunately the one that damages fetuses, babies, embryos
right.
the most.
We only got a couple of minutes, and we haven't talked about breastfeeding and alcohol. Perhaps we should say something.
So there are things out there that say have a glass of, you know, can of beer in order to increase your letdown or increase your milk volume or whatever. And we don't think it's the alcohol that's actually improving the milk production. It's probably the barley, because other kinds of alcohol don't work the same way. We do know that alcohol directly, you know, does get into the breast milk very quickly. If she's had a glass of wine, it's probably in the breast milk for a couple, 3 hours. There are some studies looking at very occasional alcohol use in breastfeeding where mom has, you know, perhaps dumped the next breastfeed, or the next breast milk, and then gone on to feeding, you know, at 6 hours as opposed to 3 hours after ingesting alcohol. Alcohol is a depressant, so it does in fact influence the baby's nursing and suckling response. It can make them sleepy. They may not wake to feed as often. And women who are using alcohol regularly really are recommended to not be using breastfeeding at all.
Can I say something? With the breastfeeding, I'd say anything that you eat, your baby's going to eat.
Mm-hmm, that's right.
Anything that you bring into your body while you're breastfeeding, you're going to give it to your baby. So,
right.
Mm-hmm,
yeah.
That's right.
It's quite true. And alcohol gets into fat very easily.
Yes.
And that's what
a
high percentage of fat. So that's why it gets into our brain and why it gets into breast milk so quickly.
Yeah,
Thanks for telling us that.
Yeah.
Well, listen, I think we need to stop at this point. I want to say thanks to each and every one of you. Eva in particular, I think it's remarkable for you to come in and share your story. We appreciate it very much. I think it's very helpful.
It was fun being here, and you're welcome.
Betsy, thank you for sharing what you do for a living. And Marilyn, I appreciate very much helping us understand all the effects of alcohol that we're coming to understand.
Thank you.
I want to mention that on our website at Alaska Public Media or public.org, there are a number of resources, including a short video about a family living with fetal alcohol spectrum disorder, some of the information from the CDC and Alaska, the state of Alaska, as well as Maryland's office, where you can refer individuals of some concern to be diagnosed and looked at more thoroughly. If you would like to continue some of the discussion on fetal alcohol spectrum disorder, you can join us on KSKA on Facebook, and you can find that link at alaskapublic.org as well. Next week, I want to remind everybody school is starting up again, and many children and adolescents are really struggling to achieve their maximum potential in school, often due to an inability to focus, stay on task, complete tests and assignments. This is often due to attention deficit disorder, or also known as ADD. So we're going to attack that problem next week on Line 1, Your Health Connection at 2 p.m. Remember, we repeat at 8 p.m. on FM 91.1. Pat Yak is Chief Content Officer at Alaska Public Media. Dave Waldron graciously engineered today's program. I'm Dr. Thad Woodard. Have a great day.
Line 1 is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the host and participants and do not reflect the underwriters or KSKA. Learn more about Line 1 and listen online at alaskapublic.org. Life Informed. This is Alaska Public Media.